Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. On today's episode, I interview my friend and colleague, Nancy Gunsberg. I met Nancy about 30 years ago at the gym that we both worked out at, and I didn't realize at the time that she was actually a mental health professional, but we got to know each other slowly over the years, and we have referred people back and forth. I asked Nancy to come on the show because, again, I want everyone in my audience to know what a very qualified, loving mental health professional sounds like. So I hope you enjoy this episode when I interview Nancy Gunsberg. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I welcome a woman that I met, I think we tried to figure it out, maybe 30 years ago at the athletic club that we both were a member of. Her name is Nancy Gunsberg. She is a mental health professional in town, a licensed clinical social worker. Good. Okay. She and I don't even remember how we met, but we've formed a bond pretty quickly and really have enjoyed talking to each other over the years. And Nancy just recently taught me a really valuable lesson that I needed to be taught again, which is not to assume anything. Because I've always known Nancy to be a very private person, and so I never invited her on the podcast because I just made the assumption that that you wouldn't be interested because you're so private. And then you sent me a note saying, how come you haven't invited me on the podcast? And I thought, oh, Dana, you made a big mistake again. So I really want to let you know how much I appreciate you coming on the show. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about who you are. And we'll kind of go from there.
So who I am, that's a big moving target question.
Yes.
But I guess I'll start at the beginning, which Please. Is I grew up in Buffalo, New York, in a sort of upper middle class neighborhood and family, and very privileged. Of course, at the time, didn't quite know how privileged, but we had all the things we needed and more. Went to good schools. We went to a fantastic summer camp in the Adirondacks. I mean, it was a very, materially, we had everything. But strangely enough, there was no feeling of love in the family. It was a very repressed family characterized by distance. And my mother had severe depression, although at the time we didn't know what it was. She was just kind of in bed every day when we would come home from school.
So every day you came home to a mom in bed?
Every day we came home. And mom would be in bed. Dad was at work.
Okay.
He worked very hard, and he was always preoccupied with work. So it was kind of both parents were very unavailable for different reasons. And so that really instilled in me that I wasn't worth much and that it wasn't, nobody was interested in listening to me and hearing what I had to say and finding out about what I was interested in. And so pretty much my sister and I got pretty dismissed.
How old were you when you sort of became aware of the fact that you were living a lonely kind of emotionally isolated experience?
Well, that's a good question, because I always knew that I'd want to be out of the house all the time. And we had a great little neighborhood with lots of kids, and I'd always want to be outside you know, playing with the kids.
Playing with the other kids.
And I'd always want to be at a friend's house. And I never really wanted to have friends at my house. I sort of ended up calling it the dead zone.
The dead zone.
Yeah.
Stephen and, King.
Sorry?
Stephen King.
Yeah. And so I remember liking to go to my friend's house for dinner because after dinner I would wash the dishes and I'd be in the center of their family.
Right.
You know, everybody would be around me. And I felt like I belonged and that I had a purpose there. I could wash their dishes.
Right.
So that's a memory that's just always stuck with me.
Are you still friends with the person that... No, okay.
Actually, she died.
Oh,
she
I'm
was
sorry.
My best friend for a long time.
Wow.
And they were not as privileged as we were. So they were kind of my poorer friends.
Right.
And...
What did your dad do for a living during that period?
He was in men's clothing.
Okay.
And worked very hard, but he was home every night, sort of behind the television. And so they sent me to... a private all-girls school called the Buffalo Seminary.
A seminary, but you came from a Jewish family.
Right, right.
Interesting.
But my mother went there and her mother went there. And it wasn't a parochial school, but it wasn't. But we did have chapel every morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was your mom Jewish also or just your dad?
Yes, both my parents were Jewish.
So why would they send you to a parochial school? That's unusual for the time.
Yeah, it wasn't really considered a parochial school.
Oh, okay.
Although it was called the Buffalo Seminary. But I was furious, and I did not want to go there. All my friends went to the public school.
Oh, okay.
You know, it was a good education they gave you. I was just furious. So... by my senior year, I sort of ran away with my history teacher.
Wait a second. Your senior year of high school?
Yeah.
So you were in that school your whole educational...
For four years of high school.
Oh, for high school, but not elementary school? Or
no, I went to a public school.
Oh, okay. Okay. And was your early education okay in the public school?
Yeah.
You made friends and you were had a pretty sort of a normal upper middle class life.
Yeah.
So high school, you ran away with your history teacher. That's interesting.
Yeah.
How did that take place?
Well, it just did. You know, he was a very charismatic, smart guy that everybody thought he was having an affair with Elise Malin, myself included. There was a senior play that we were both at. He was actually sitting behind me with the headmaster's wife. And I was sitting with my friends. And as we came out of the play, I had said that I needed a ride home to my friends.
Oh, okay.
And he kind of turned around and said, well, I can drop you off after I drop off the headmaster's wife. So that's how it happened.
I'm sorry I laughed. Let me show you my etchings.
Right, right. Of course, I had no idea that would be the case.
No?
No.
So, I mean, how did it turn into a romantic relationship?
Well, so he dropped her off at the Larkin House, which was the headmaster's house. And then we were driving down my street, and I saw my father's head in the window watching TV, as he always did. And I mumbled sort of, oh, gosh, I don't want to go home. And so he just drove right past.
Wow.
And drove us to a bar. And we had a drink.
And you were how old?
I had just turned 18.
Oh, okay.
And it was legal in New York.
Oh, okay.
To drink. So that's how it started, and it was very secretive. Nobody knew about it. We would go to cemeteries to visit.
Cemeteries?
Yeah, where everybody was dead. Nobody would know us. So, and that was it. We were together 4 years. We came out here together.
Really? So you fell in love with each other?
Well,
no?
He fell in love with me. He wanted to get married. He was kind of my ticket out.
Oh, okay.
I was so lost. I was really lost. And, you know, eventually got into drugs and got, you know, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, it was the late 60s and early 70s. Mm-hmm. And for 11 years, I was lost in drugs, sex, and an eating disorder.
Oh, okay.
And a massive depression.
Wow.
And I clearly knew I was medicating myself.
And what kind of drugs were your drugs of choice?
Well, it depended where I was working. You know, if I was a waitress, it was cocaine. If I was, I worked all night in a photo lab, and then it was downers. And I found a therapist who did psychedelic therapy.
Wow.
And Primal Scream at the same time. And so I was searching, just searching to find ways to really get out of these addictions. I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what was wrong.
And were you in New York still at the time in Buffalo?
We were in New York for 2 years before we came out here.
To California?
Yeah.
To Santa Barbara or California?
Yeah, we came. Well, first we were in Berkeley for a summer and then... we came here.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how long did the relationship go on?
It was 4 years.
4 years. Okay. And what brought it to an end?
Oh, I was 18. He was 37.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Yeah. It was, and I knew it was not going to last.
Okay.
I knew he was kind of my ticket out and to get me settled and I learned a tremendous amount from him about the world.
Uh-huh.
And he was one of the beatniks in the early, in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And in New York. So he moved to Greenwich Village in the West Village, and it was a fantastic time to be there in 68, 69, 70.
Yeah.
We came out here in 70. And I had had a year of college, but on Long Island, but I didn't see what the purpose of that was, so I dropped out.
And how did your parents see the relationship?
They didn't know for a couple years.
Oh, okay.
And then when I eventually told them, they were pretty good, I have to say. They knew they would lose me.
Oh, okay.
So they were pretty good, and he actually ended up having Thanksgiving dinner at our house at one point.
Wow.
Yeah. So they came around, and So I went on this search because I knew I was depressed. I knew I was medicating myself. I knew it didn't make sense for me to take drugs for medication. Because I thought, well, if I'm depressed, why am I depressed? What's being depressed? I had such a fever about knowing what that was.
Okay.
And I really did not know.
Wow.
I just had no idea. I mean, I knew my mom was depressed. And
yeah.
There was maybe a genetic component. But there was so much more that I didn't really understand. I also knew I was very hungry for love.
Yeah.
And I think that's what all my promiscuity was about.
Sure.
Those 11 years of taking drugs.
Yeah.
So I did find the AA program. That was very helpful for about 2 years.
Here in Santa Barbara?
Yes. And meanwhile, I was searching. Oh, I went to all the churches and the temples and the... I did so many different things, like I said, this LSD therapy and Primal Scream, and I probably went to a dozen therapists here in town, and I had different jobs. I was a very functioning, depressed person. I always went to work. I always was on time. I always got up and made my bed, you know. Uh-huh. I was not one of those people who laid in bed. And I always exercised.
So despite being depressed, you took as good a care of yourself as you were able.
Well, as I was able.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's relative to how much pain that you're in and you know, what kind of symptomatology you were coping with.
Right. And the eating disorder. I think that was the most shameful thing.
Were you anorexic or bulimic?
I was a binger starver.
Oh, okay.
So, and that's how I sort of tried to control my weight, although I had 70 more pounds on me than I do now.
Oh, okay.
So I had a lot more weight on me. But and I was so filled with self-loathing and shame and really self-hate. I mean, it was just, I still think, my gosh, where did this come from?
Right.
It was so intense. And it just took me decades, really.
To come to terms with it?
To, you know, get off my own case.
Yeah.
And to learn to still that critical, judgmental voice. And it was really that I, you know, one thing that was really important for me was the psychedelic experience. Mm-hmm. And was interning with Jon Kabat-Zinn. Have you heard of him? He's the mindfulness-based stress reduction clinic in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Because I eventually went back to school to Smith, and so I was in Massachusetts.
Oh, so you went back east then for a while?
Yeah, just for a couple, 2.5 years to get through the program.
Okay.
And then I interned with him at his clinic. He's really the one. He's a molecular biologist. He was really the one who brought mindfulness into our culture. Huh. And his clinic was incredible. He told all the East Coast doctors, send me your worst patients that you don't know what to do with, that have so much pain, that have so much that you don't know how to treat. And so he would get all these patients up and down the East Coast, and he would teach them how to meditate.
Wow.
And to see people, it was an 8-week program, and the interns, we were interns, it was a 10-week program. And every time after the clinic, we would go through what they went through, and then we'd have a process class after. And to see, it was just to see these people transformed. What was so interesting to me is that the problems didn't go away. But they learned how to be with their problems in a different way.
Right.
So you'd have a pilot who had panic attacks, or you'd have a woman who had terrible chronic fatigue and couldn't take care of her kids, her little kids. She couldn't drive them around and stuff. So she would talk about, you know, she'd sit on her bed, and the kids would come on, lay on the bed with her. And they'd laugh and they'd talk. And, you know, so she just sort of changed the way that she was managing what was wrong and didn't beat herself up because she couldn't, you know, drive her kids around.
So it sounds like this affected the way you looked at yourself really deeply.
Well, I think that was the beginning of... Well, it wasn't the beginning of my meditation practice because that's been going on ever since I got sober, which was 1981.
Okay.
So I was meditating before I got there. And I had studied with him for 5 days in Virginia before I did this internship. So he was always somebody I was very interested in, along with Richie Davidson. Have you heard that name? Yeah, he's at the University of Wisconsin. And he talks about how we have to train ourselves to be happy. Hmm. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, I used to think happiness befell some of us and others not. But I see now that's not the case. That it's like learning to tame the mind and train the heart. And calm the body. Those three things were really essential for me in my healing. And that when I had gone to so many therapists and they all said, you have to feel your feelings, I never knew how to do that.
Oh, okay.
And nobody could tell me. And it wasn't really until I found a psychoanalyst who could deeply help me, and I know you're not, you don't have great opinions of them, but this guy really helped me get to what was wrong.
Okay.
And not that anything was wrong, but get to what I was suffering with.
And eventually, how would you conceptualize that now that you had that kind of therapy?
Well, I think it unpacked all the conditioning that I had been holding for all those decades. You know, it was all pushed down and created these complexes and these projections and this self-loathing that just was part of this conditioning that just kept going on and on and on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see this when people come into our offices that they are operating on an old conditioning that never got, you know, updated.
Right.
So I think part of my work, certainly with them, is to help them see how this conditioning got laid down for them. I actually believe part of it gets laid down in our mother's womb. We're actually eating our mothers.
Right.
And so this depression, you know, which on my mother's side, all the women on my mother's side, this includes my sisters and her kids and their kids, they're all depressed. And, you know, so... And what is it we're taking in? We're not only taking in their genetics, but we're taking in the food they're eating, the thoughts they're thinking, the feelings they're having.
Right.
So we're taking everything in.
Yeah.
And it just has a huge impact on us. And, you know, most of us spend the rest of our lives trying to get out of that.
Oh, I know what you're saying is absolutely true. On the podcast before, I described a situation that that I recalled when I was doing hypnosis, being inside my mom as a 6 months of gestation. My mom was in the basement washing clothes with my little sister. My dad came home from work, and she knew that he was having an affair with his secretary, so they had a knockdown, drag-out fight in the basement. And I recalled feeling really strongly that my mother blamed being pregnant for the affair that my father was having, believing that she was ugly. So I distinctly remember through the umbilical cord taking in my mom's ugliness and pain and being completely contaminated by her self-hate before I was even born. Because then when I was born, I was allergic to her milk. And I almost died because I couldn't digest her milk. And it took about 3 months for them to figure out what was wrong with me. Because I just couldn't connect with her on any healthy level. So I agree with you that you can be extremely traumatized. And if you're a really sensitive person, you're going to start taking the pain in even before you're born. Now, I've had people tell me that that's not possible to remember. But about a year after I told my wife about that experience, my mom just spontaneously had lunch with my wife and told her that that happened. Not the part where I took in her pain, but the fight in the basement. So I know that that was real, and I know that I remembered it. So that kind of gave me confirmation that what you're saying is absolutely mm-hmm. true, that we can absorb all kinds of stuff in utero that's not so good for us moving forward. And that usually can be the beginning of that feeling of loneliness and failure for not being able to save your mom from herself and all of that stuff that happens when you're a really empathic person, which I know you to be.
It's amazing you remembered that. I mean, that's spectacular.
Actually. Well, it helps me both personally and professionally to know that that's, you know, that's a real thing in quotes.
Right.
Because, you know, as a therapist, you can't help anybody go any further than you've gone yourself. So I feel incredibly blessed that, you know, that I know that those things are real so that when I meet someone that may have had that kind of an experience, I'm not going to tell them that it's not true.
Oh, yeah. No, I've never tell people that their experience isn't true, right? Because it's their experience, yeah.
So, Nancy, was there any overt trauma that you had sort of blocked out that was part of your healing process, or was it more just chronic loneliness and feelings of deprivation?
Yeah, I you know, and I think that's what was so confusing to me, and I think this is a really important question and distinction to make. You know, there's the big traumas like the abuse and the hitting and the, you know, or the war trauma or the fire trauma or the really living with somebody who's mentally ill trauma.
Yeah.
Or the loss of a child or something. But for me, this was really a developmental trauma that made it so invisible. Really, although there was no touching, there was no kissing, there was no I love you, there was no holding, there was no hugging. I never saw my mother and father do any of that.
Wow.
So, but that just seemed normal in a way.
Yeah.
So this developmental trauma, which I think is less understood, because people will come in and they don't know what's wrong a lot of the time. They just don't feel good.
Right.
And they want to be happy. And they want to feel better about themselves. And they don't know why they feel the way they do. And so then they end up blaming themselves.
Right.
And as children, it's easier to blame ourselves than to think mom and dad are not capable of loving me.
Right.
And we can't do that.
No, you can't even know that.
Right. So we develop, which at the time is a very resourceful way of building these, you know, defenses.
Right.
But as we grow older, they really start to work against us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this was classic me right here. And, you know, once I came to understand that, through this analysis, it really made a big difference. However, the self-loathing was still there, even though I could see why I developed in the way I did. So it was really the confluence of the meditation that was so necessary for me to relax my body. You know, I could not relax my body. And I remember in the 80s, Herbert Benson's book, remember that? The Relaxation Response was a big book then. And I thought, yeah, I need to relax because everybody tells me I got to feel my feelings, but I can't feel them when I'm all contracted and tight.
Right.
So I started meditating. I had no idea what I was doing. I just sat down and was quiet and didn't move.
Right.
And, you know, 10 years later, I started reading something about Buddhist psychology, and I thought, oh, the wheel has been invented.
Right.
You know, they've been doing this.
Somebody's, for a long time.
Somebody's got it all mapped out for me. And so then I started learning about Buddhist psychology.
Oh, okay.
And that helped me a lot also.
Right.
Because what it showed me is that things are always changing. Nothing stays the same.
Right.
We don't stay the same. Nothing stays the same. And so it got to this issue of the self versus no self. And this is a very hard Western concept for people to accept.
Right.
We don't need to go off on that. But that became a big part of my practice, was realizing that this self that I see when I look in the mirror when I get up in the morning is a constantly moving target, and that there's the sum of the parts. There's something greater than the sum of the parts.
Right.
And I know you talk about intuition a lot and sort of a higher power or God, whatever you want to call it. And that's what the psychedelic experience did for me.
It helped you connect with that part of yourself?
Yes.
So what was that like for you?
The psychedelic experience?
Yeah, because, I mean, now it's become vogue and really popular, but we're talking about a while ago.
40 years ago.
Yeah, 40 years ago when it was still maybe legal, but barely, or not even legal anymore?
No, it was not legal.
Okay.
And I found a husband and wife team who were doing it.
Here in Santa Barbara?
Yeah. And, but it was with this primal therapy, so the idea was to break your defenses down.
Oh, okay.
And, but what it did for me is, I just remember going out on her porch and seeing all of the energy moving, and that there was no boundary around anything, no boundary around you, around me. It was all just moving at different speeds and different densities. And that right there just was my spiritual foundation, seeing that everything is moving phenomenon and it's all energy. And it's all moving inside of us as we're sitting here, you know, fairly still, that there's constant fluidity going on.
And how does that help you feel a sense of a kind of spiritual connection?
Well, that there's something so much bigger happening here than my little self and the little bubble I live in.
Yeah.
And the comfort that I, you know, crave, you know. I like to be comfortable. Well, life isn't always comfortable.
No and kidding.
And so how to learn how to expand our window of tolerance for discomfort. And that's where the Buddhist psychology has really helped me a lot, because there is no self. So it's all very temporary, except with chronic pain, you know, doesn't feel temporary.
No, that's true.
And so you know, and I had a cancer diagnosis and went through a lot of pain, and so now even learning to work with pain is another interest of mine. Because we all have it on some level.
Yeah.
Some people much more than others. And it's just been interesting to see how the mind is such a big part of pain and what we think and what we dwell on. You know, becomes the inclination of how we're experiencing life.
So that's one of the philosophies that you bring into your therapy practice, I'm assuming.
Well, you know, I had a therapist once say to me, she said, the way for you is going to be through your body. So that's a very important piece for me, is working with the body. Now, I was a massage therapist before I was a therapist.
Oh, okay.
So I came up through the body. You know, I thought, oh, if I become a massage therapist, I'll heal myself. But that didn't quite do it, because, you know, there's still the mind. And that's actually, in some ways, the more difficult thing to tame.
Right.
It's, you know, anybody who's tried meditation, I can't do it. My mind just won't quit. And that's exactly the point, you know. It doesn't stop because the mind is there to think. That's what the mind does. So if we want to get it to do something else, it takes tremendous practice.
Right.
So that's been another very exciting learning edge for me, that what does happen in my meditations now when the mind settles and the boundaries are lost. That's a big interest for me.
So how did you go to come to the conclusion of becoming a therapist, actually?
Well, I think I was trying to figure myself out.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome to becoming a therapist,
yeah,
right?
So I had to explore all these different ways in my attempt to heal myself.
Okay.
And I remember reading a book. It was called Love, Medicine, and Miracles. Do you remember that book by Bernie Siegel? Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, it was one of those inspiring things. Mm-hmm. And he would talk about how 80% of people would rather have a surgery than change their mind.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
In fact, when some people come in for therapy, they think they're going to, you know, handle this tiny slice of the pie here, and they don't realize they have to work on the whole pie.
Yes.
And some people don't want to do that.
Well, it takes a lot of courage, in my opinion, and a lot of dedication, and a lot of strength, a lot of money. You know, it is a ongoing process. And a lot of times what I've found also in addition to that is that some people do therapy at a certain time in their life, and they figure once they come to terms at that time that they won't ever need therapy again. And what we forget is that, you know, over the course of our lifetime, things change a great deal. And so other issues come up. And I've found many people believe that they've sort of failed themselves because another issue comes up and they think, well, what happened to all the therapy I did? So I agree with you. It's a huge amount of dedication and time and money and effort.
Yeah.
Courage.
And commitment.
And commitment.
Commitment.
Yeah.
Huge commitment. And and you make a decision to do it or you
don't. Yeah. And it's scary.
Yeah. But, you know, to me, it got to the point where it was more scary going the way. Because I didn't think I would make it, quite frankly.
Right.
I just knew I couldn't continue going down the road I was going down. So it became less scary.
So where did you go to school to do your training?
Smith College, back east.
Oh, that was to become a licensed?
LCSW.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then you came back to Santa Barbara after?
Yeah. I had always planned to do that.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. And so. And I did my internships here. I worked at the Cancer Center. I worked at Sansom. I worked at Cottage. I worked at the Center for Psychiatry. It was a private group thing. I love doing groups. And so I had a lot of medical training in the medical world, not medical training myself.
Right, right.
But, and it just, I worked at hospice for 4 years. It just, there was a lot to be desired in the medical training.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to get out of that field. You know, initially I thought, oh, I can bring some light to the hospital.
Right.
But it just grinds you down.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do it. So then I did go into private practice.
Which is, in my mind, the best alternative because then you get to kind of be the master of your own destiny.
Yeah.
And when you come from a background, our backgrounds are somewhat similar. It feels good to sort of have some control over how you do your thing, and you don't have people telling you how to do it and what to do with it and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. And how to work in organizations that don't have the values you do.
Right.
And so it becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
So what kinds of issues do you work with people in your practice at this point?
Currently now?
Yeah.
So I work with, as you have said, I've heard you say that it doesn't matter so much what the presenting problem is because those are the symptoms.
Right.
So whether it's depression, anxiety, relational problems, we quickly get to what's causing those things.
Right.
And that can happen rather quickly. And I'm sorry to say it often goes back to their history. Although I don't think it's necessary to delve into the history Because when a person comes into your office, they are coming in with their whole history. It's right there in front of you. And that's what was so hard with COVID, because I didn't see people in person. And I really need the whole body to see and feel what's going on.
Right.
And there's a wonderful selection of words that I like, that I learned from Diana Fossa, who does this AEDP therapy. And she would say, you make the implicit explicit. So in other words, you're making the unconscious conscious, and you're making the explicit experiential. So you're helping them to, whatever comes up, to feel it. And you're making the experiential relational. So how is that happening between us? Because they come in so much with relationship problems.
Right.
And so how are their patterns of relationship showing up between you two? And then you make the relational transformative. And I think this part is often missing. It was missing in my analysis even, making the relational transformative.
So how would you describe that for the layperson?
So I think a lot of times what happens for all of us is we might have a pleasant moment. We might feel good about, you know, seeing the wind blow or the bird on the branch or whatever, but it gets dismissed so quickly that we don't even notice that we had that moment, really. And so when I watch somebody come through this process that I've just described, and then I ask them, how is it? How do they feel now? And they say, well, I feel better. And I say, well, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. I just feel good. Mm-hmm. And so I try and get them to describe what is good like. I mean, what evidence do you have for this? And they'll say, well, I feel lighter, or I feel more relaxed. Okay, so that's some good description. What else? Well, I feel less burdened, or I feel more hopeful. Or I feel happier. And so we really amplify that and work with that, because that's what they want. They want all those things.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times in therapy that gets missed.
You mean the positive parts of life?
Yes. And that to amplify when they actually feel good. How did that happen? You know, what have we done that together that made that happen? And so we might, you know, well, I don't know, they'll say. And so I might say, well, do you want to look at the sequence of what we just did? So they can learn how to do this with themselves.
To create joy.
To create joy and to create calmness and relaxation. I mean, people come in, you know, they're all tight and yes. You can see it. Mm-hmm. And then to watch them just transform before your very eyes, you know, and often crying is involved, or
sure.
Being angry or whatever it is, trembling with fear, whatever it is. But you watch that happen, and it's just mind-blowing.
Feels good.
It feels good.
So, Nancy, one of the things that I ask people all the time is, what do you think the purpose of your life is? One of the conclusions that I've sort of come to is that one purpose that you're describing right now is to show somebody what Nancy's love looks like, what your version of love looks like. Because everything that you're describing is an act of love that you are giving to the people that come to see you so that they can feel what it's like to be loved in a way that they've never felt before. Now, I know you're not supposed to talk about love as a therapist because you're just conceivably not supposed to get involved on a personal level with the people that come to see you. you know, for all the different ways that we could end up exploiting people according to the state of California and all that. But I guess I just want to make it clear that your expression of love is very clear when you talk about what you do. And I want to make sure that I acknowledge that, because I think that, maybe without realizing it, that's what you're showing people, is Nancy, what love looks like from Nancy's perspective. And I think that that's very sweet, because I think that that's primarily what helps a person get to a place where they start maybe receiving love from other sources. Because a lot of people have never been loved properly in the course of their life. And when they start to experience it in a clean way, which is what you're describing, then they know what to look for moving out into the world. So again, I'm not sure if you agree with me, but I was just sitting here thinking, boy, Nancy's a very loving person. And I just wasn't sure if you realized how much love that you were expressing in the way that you help the people that come into your world.
Well, that's not a word that occurs to me.
Well, because we're not encouraged to look at what we do from that perspective.
Well, yeah, it's not that I have a problem with that, because I think it is the love that heals.
Uh-huh.
I think that is the main healer.
Right.
But I don't think of myself particularly as a loving person.
Really?
I think of myself as an empathetic person.
Okay.
And maybe a compassionate person. That's mostly because of my sensitivities, yes. I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But loving is not a word.
But aren't those ingredients in the expression of love? Compassion, and sensitivity, yes. A willingness to listen? I mean, how many people that you encounter in your own life are interested in listening to what you have to say? And instead of formulating their response when you're only halfway done with your sentence, actually, they're really willing to listen to what you have to say. It's difficult to find, I think, even in friendships sometimes.
Yes.
Right? We have a tendency to want to, answer before the other person's done. And I think as a therapist, at least if you're a good therapist, which I know that you are, that you probably listen more than you realize and allow the person to really express themselves as much as they need to before you jump in to be of service. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes, I think it's a rare thing.
Yeah.
It's true. I agree. And, you know, we get good at listening because that's what we do.
Well, when you say we, I agree with you that you and I do that, but I don't know that that's as common in the therapy world as you are supposing, because one of the reasons why I have interviewed mental health professionals on my podcast is because I want people to be able to tell the difference between somebody who is using a cookbook in order to help the people that come into their lives and someone who's really capable of being present and really helping the person come to terms with the fact that they don't believe they're lovable, but you're going to hopefully show them the parts of them that are lovable and help them really recognize that most of the ways that we blame ourselves, it's like a case of mistaken identity, right? That if we were held accountable for the way we talk to ourselves, we'd all be in jail for assault. And it's hard to break that habit, but I think that once people realize that that's a way of managing fear, it's a little bit easier to be kinder when you realize that we all got to manage fear. Taking it out on yourself is probably not the best way. So again, I know I'm going on a bit here, but I just wanted to acknowledge that I'm getting to know you in a way that I never have before, and I can just sense how much love that you bring to the table. So whether you recognize or not, it shows up, at least in my sitting here with you. And I think it's very sweet. Because it's coming from a very gentle place.
Well, and I do find, you know, I do love my patients, you uh-huh. know. And I may not at the first session.
Well, but it's not always love at first sight for you, huh?
but when you hear what people have been through,
oh, yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It's astounding.
It is astounding.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had somebody come to me once, very old, over 90, and very sophisticated defenses and high functioning, no health problems, zero. I said, maybe I should be coming to see you. I mean, I just couldn't believe she slept well.
Wow.
It was like,
what was she doing in therapy?
Exactly. But what we saw is that she wasn't viscerally connected to herself.
Oh, okay.
So it was very intellectualized and understood everything. There wasn't anything I said she didn't understand. But this visceral connection with the body was missing.
Wow.
And was causing some problems.
I can imagine. So what are the things you think are important for people to kind of think about in the process of their own development and healing?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to be present and to realize that not everything we think is true.
I'm sorry to laugh. That's a relief, right? Because all think that what we think is real.
And it's just as a teacher of mine said once, a Hakomi teacher of mine said, he said 80% is junk. And most of it we thought yesterday and the day before. And it's so true. Yeah. You know, very rarely do we have new insights or thoughts.
So then what is the source of reality, I guess, from your perspective? Is it how you feel?
Well, I think if you are present with yourself and not going off on those train of thoughts that take us all away all the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes for hours and days at a time.
And years.
Yeah, exactly. And so the more you stay present, the more you can learn about yourself, about what your mind does, about how you feel, about what your body's doing. And that's really important.
And what feels important to you about that? What's important about that?
Well, it's we get to know ourselves.
Okay. So that's really where coming to really know who you are comes into the picture.
I think so. We get to know ourselves, and then we get to connect deeply with who we are. So, you know, so many people come in, and they don't know what to do. They don't have a purpose. They're working a job they don't like. It's so common because it hasn't really connected up to their deepest desires and what's really special about them. And so it's getting people connected to that. And everybody's got something to give. They wouldn't be here. That's my thought.
Okay.
If they didn't. I think when people come to our doors, they are already hit the ground running because they've got resilience, they've got interest, they've got resources, they've got a dedication to working on themselves. So already they have tons of stuff going for them, but they don't see it that way.
No. So what about the notion that we are, from the beginning of our lives, conditioned to view our value based on our performance rather than who we are as person?
That's right.
Because that kind of goes along with what you're saying, is that part of your job and my job is to teach people who they are separate from how they perform in the world, or maybe in addition to how they perform.
Right.
In the world.
Right. I still struggle with that.
With myself. How you perform in the world as a sign of value?
Yes. And that, you know, I'm never doing enough. Never.
But is that not, and again, I'm going to be a little facetious, but is that not the Jewish way? At least it was in my family, that you're never allowed to be satisfied with anything, and if you are, there's something wrong with you, and that you always have to be striving for things to be different and to have more, which damns you to a life of never being satisfied and never really being able to appreciate what it is that you have created for yourself and what you do have.
I think there's truth to that, you know, and my mother did nothing. I mean, she right. couldn't do anything.
But
so.
I mean, it sounds like she was chronically really, really depressed.
And yes.
So,
and but there's this phrase in Jewish theology, perhaps you've heard it. It's called Tikkun Olam.
I've heard of it, but I can't remember what it means.
Yeah, it means to repair the world.
Oh, okay.
So that's, you know, coming from privilege, uh-huh. that feels like it's my job.
Right.
To do that in uh-huh. whatever small and, you know, bigger ways I can do. And so I'm learning to appreciate the small ways I can do it.
Yeah.
You know, like smiling and saying hello to a stranger. Or just those letting somebody go ahead of me in the traffic.
Right.
You know, because I can't do these masterful things, you know.
Yeah.
I can't run a nonprofit. And
well, it's one of the reasons why I started the podcast, because I love being a therapist and I can only see a limited number of people. And I thought to myself, how do I figure out a way to help as many people as possible before someday I fall out of my chair? And the only thing I could come up with was doing a podcast and kind of bringing people like yourself here to talk about healing and you know, what it takes to be connected to yourself and so on and so forth. Because I mean, in our world right now, it's more important than it ever has been before. Because, the philosophy is kind of designed for us to not like each other rather than try to figure out a way to have that kindness that you're talking about. Right? The idea that you would actually smile and say hello to a stranger, what the hell's wrong with you, right? Don't you know that they should or could be your enemy? it's ridiculous, but anyway.
Yeah, the world is really in bad shape.
A little scary. I'm wondering what else you might want to impart the podcast listeners with that we haven't spoken about yet. Is there anything left in your mind that we haven't gotten to yet?
I think it's really important to take time to slow down and let yourself feel and be reflective about yourself.
Is that what you do in your meditations, or are there other ways you do that too?
You know, I listened to this famous author say she spent about 4 or 5 hours on her mental health every day.
4 or 5 hours? Wow.
And I thought, well, I probably spend 3 or 4.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
And well, when you factor in exercise,
okay,
meditation,
yeah,
eating well,
okay,
cleaning up,
right,
that can be 4 hours right there.
Oh, okay. So it's a bit of a broader definition of working on your mental health than than just contemplating your navel.
Well, no, right. Mental health includes a lot of those things you have to do.
Yes, that is true.
And good sleep and all those things.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be disrespectful. But it is true. It's, you know, every time I walk to the park in the morning, I drive to get there. I see more people in line at McDonald's and 7-Eleven for breakfast than there are people who are driving to the parking lot of the park. And I think to myself, yeah, they're starting their life with grease and salt and fat and sugar. It's like, wow, if that's how you start your day, how do you function in the world? But, you know, that's how we're taught to sort of live our lives, is in a big hurry and getting things done as quickly as we can and being as efficient as we can. And it does preclude being mindful and taking care of yourself.
Yeah, and being real busy. I don't like to be real busy.
No.
Yeah. Some people do, and some people thrive on it. And I wish I had more of that gene, but I don't.
Well, I so appreciate you coming on the podcast. It's been very kind of you to express your, you know, the way that you see the world and how you see yourself as a therapist. And again, I appreciate the fact that you reminded me that it's really important to not assume anything about the people that you know. So again, I thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Dana.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.